there's a huge new activist movement afoot for democracy and justice. Two new books have come out with tools and models for that movement.
This is the book of action. This is a book that takes away your excuses. This is a book that shows it's easier than we think to make dramatic change in this country.
That's Ralph Nader. He tells us how to build a movement that can bridge left and right to promote real democracy. His new book is Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think. Then Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine tells us why she set out on a 12,000-mile odyssey around America to find models for grassroots action.
So after 20 years of doing this work, I just thought, you know, is this really working? Are we really making progress? And if not, where are the sources of progress? Because Yes was founded to find solutions. And, you know, and I had to ask myself, were we looking in the right places?
Van Gelder tells us of all the places she found where ordinary people were working together to solve their common problems. Her book is The Revolution Where You Live. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. On January 21st, women and men around the world came out in the millions to stand up for women's rights, human rights, and democracy. Many observers asked whether it was a flash in the pan or the beginning of a new people's movement. I don't know about you, but since the election, I've seen signs that the American people are waking up to defend rights they feel are threatened by the new administration and Republicans in Congress. Women's rights, environmental rights, voting rights, civil rights, workers' rights, and the rights of immigrants. My guests this hour have dedicated their lives to what we can call deep democracy. Ralph Nader is an American hero. His activism has been credited with the passage of landmark laws for protecting American consumers, including the Clean Water Act, the Freedom of Information Act, the Consumer Product Safety Act, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and the National Traffic and Motor Vehicle Safety Act. That last one mandated the seatbelts that have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Nader has been repeatedly named to lists of the 100 most influential Americans, including those by Life magazine and Time magazine. He's the founder of the pro-democracy organization Public Citizen. His new book, Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think, is a guide for activists, whether newly minted or experienced, who want to exert the power of the people to move our political system on our behalf. Well, Ralph Nader, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
The last time we spoke with you, we actually talked with you about your book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. That was a very long book about imagining what if you could get a bunch of billionaires together to do the change that we need in this country, to have more justice, more social justice. This one is completely different. It's a short book, Breaking Through Power, and the focus is not on the super rich, but on the rest of us. Why the change?
Well, the two go together. In the super rich book, it was a top-down, bottom-up reform where the rich guys funded a lot of grassroots effort, a new elections, clean elections party, and other ways to mobilize the neighborhoods and seek new leadership of civil groups. This one is very relevant to today's Trump administration. The subtitle to Breaking Through Power, this little paperback, is It's Easier Than We Think. And I've, over the years, learned that one of the obstacles to people getting civically engaged, or politically engaged, for that matter, is they think it's useless, that it can't be done. The big boys will decide. Why waste your time? And I want to get people over that hump by showing throughout American history, right down to the present time, just a handful of people representing public opinion for safe food, nutritious food, safe cars, safe pharmaceuticals, have really changed a lot of bad things into good things. And so I have little descriptions of these people, including people like Ralph Hotchkiss, who revolutionized wheelchair design and broke the monopoly of wheelchair sales by the Jennings Corporation in London. The wheelchairs were high price and were easily falling apart. They weren't sturdy enough. And he met both of those. He came out of Oberlin. He had no money, no contacts. We gave him an office, and he's built this wonderful network around the Third World, teaching people how to build sturdy, inexpensive wheelchairs from local materials. And there's an example. So I say to people when I do book signings around the country on this little book, this is the book of action. This is a book that takes away your excuses. This is a book that shows it's easier than we think to make dramatic change in this country. This is the book that shows that left-right agree on a lot of things that don't appear in the newspapers, from civil liberties to clean air, to an end to corporate welfare, to criminal justice reform, and on and on. And I urge people to buy it as a six-pack. And they say, what do you mean? I say, well, six people in the living room discussing it. That's where it all starts, all over the country. And I hope they do that.
About half of the book does go into, you know, what people can do. And I think that that's a very, you know, that's obviously the most critical point of the book. And I want to get to that pretty soon. But before we do that, lay out for us, you talk, and I think you really write about this so cogently and eloquently. You lay out the terrain of the plutocracy that we live in. I mean, we have two spheres, the public and the private sphere. Talk about what's happened to the relative power of these two spheres since you became active as a public citizen, and the plutocracy that we find ourselves in today.
Yeah, it's important to show people what they're up against. And they're up against a corporatized economy and increasingly corporatized government arrayed against their own interests, whether it's living wage or full Medicare for all or cracking down on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse, billing frauds, inadequate housing, inadequate public transit, on and on. And what's happened is that the large corporation, like ExxonMobil, General Motors, Pfizer, Bank of America, they are power-concentrating machines top-down. That's what they do. And they concentrate power outward as well as inside the company, the bosses, because they have to control everything. It's called predictability. It's in their DNA. They don't like surprises. They don't like challengers. They don't like someone who may displace them or cut into their market share. That's why they always trend toward monopoly or oligopoly or joint ventures. And so I lay it all out in a very concise way so people get motivated, because when you lay out the power structure in this country, you don't deal with red state, blue state, because the power structure is abusing people whether they label themselves conservatives or liberals. They get ripped off. They get toxified. They get excluded. They get lied to. They get underinsured. It doesn't matter whether they're conservative or Republicans. Once left-right become aware of that and collaborate into an alliance, it's politically unstoppable in Congress or in state legislatures. It just is an unstoppable political movement, because the politicians cannot game the left against the right and vice versa. And they're terrified when you walk into their office and you say, we're both conservatives and liberals. They don't know how to deal with that, because it is an unstoppable force.
You lay out how to do that, but I have a question before we go further on that. You know, many of the examples you give of left-right alliances in the book date from before the turn of the 21st century. Since that time, we've had a whole kind of a cultural framework that has taken over, you know, red state America, to the extent that some, you know, some people say that no matter what the self-interest is on the part of red staters, they're going to vote against it because they see it as culturally abhorrent to connect up with any progressive causes.
Well, that's what I call the yuck factor. In other words, there are clear divisions between left and right, reproductive rights, school prayer, perceived overregulation, the kind of fights they have over gun control. And that dominates the news and all the other areas of collaboration and convergence. And I've come up with 24 of them, major ones. I just mentioned some of them. There's 75-80% for much higher minimum wage. That's a lot of conservative workers in Walmart who want that. That it's in the shadows. So when it's out in the open, then people have to say, look, Jones disagrees with Smith on abortion. Jones disagrees with Smith on school prayer. But Jones agrees with Smith on A, B, C, D, redirection and reform. So get over it. In other words, you're not compromising yourself. You're saying, okay, we agree to disagree on these areas, but let's move forward on the other areas. A lot of people can't overcome that. They say, yuck, I can't support someone like Grover Norquist, who's against corporate welfare because he's so terrible on tax issues. He wants to reduce taxes and on corporations, et cetera. I've learned in experience in Washington and elsewhere that you can't operate that way, because then you can't build the powerful civic alliances of people everywhere. If you disqualify an alliance on an important matter because on another matter you disagree, that's, you have to get over the yuck factor.
Ralph Nader, in this book, in Breaking Through Power, you really describe quite well the forces that are arrayed against the public sphere. And when we say the public sphere, it's everything from wages to climate change, environment, to, you know, media policy. The capture of the government, the capture of the courts, the capture of international trade agreements and relationships, it seems like an incredible juggernaut to go up against. Why do you think that citizens banding together can have any kind of impact, especially when studies show that, you know, the plutocrats really don't care what we think?
Well, they do care once we connect thinking with action. And the one thing about the plutocrats and members of Congress, they're still afraid of the people rising up and organizing. And if you say, well, why does Congress do the bidding of Wall Street and the military-industrial complex? Because they're organized. But do they have many votes? Not that many. 1,500 corporations or give or take control a majority of the members of Congress. They don't have any votes, those corporations. And the reason why they get away with it is because we're not organized back in each congressional district. And if we were, and it would take less than 1%, of the people, let's do the figures. 1% of adults in this country is about 2.5 to 2.7 million. There are 270 million people, adults in this country. So 1% is, say, 2.7 million. If you break that out to each of the 435 congressional districts, and you have these people pledge, remember, it's just 1 out of 100 adults. Pledge around a 10-point agenda for change, that they all agree on the 10 changes so that there's no bickering and fighting after they join the effort. So they all pre-agree. They come on. They agree to give 200 to 400 hours volunteer a year and to throw some money in the pot to open up an office with 2 or 3 or 4 full-time people. While the volunteers are at work, these people every day are bringing the agenda forward, laser beam focus on 2 senators and representatives in every congressional district. Voila, all kinds of things happen. Well, you might say, well, 1% is a lot. All right, let's take 0.5% Let's take 2,000 people. There are 700,000 men, women, children in each congressional district, give or take. So let's do 2,000. That's more than enough to get a higher minimum wage, more than enough to get full Medicare for all, because the members of the Congress know that the majority of people want this. They want Everybody in, nobody out. Health insurance, free choice of doctor and hospital, much cheaper, much better outcomes than the mess and the corruption and the profiteering that characterizes our health care industry and insurance. So you start breaking it down, and you say, you know, this is less than the number of bird watchers in the district, far less. This is like a hobby. You know, most people have hobbies. They spend $200 to $500 a year on their hobby, and a few hundred hours a year on their hobby. Why not we have a congressional watchdog hobby? Now, since this has never been done, it may be more difficult than we think, but let's say a few rich people kickstart it. Let's say they hire two or three people in every congressional district to get those 2,000 people mobilized and committed in future years to fund it. Well, that's a possibility, too. There are a lot of enlightened billionaires around, more than we need to support something like this and get it underway. Or it can get underway on its own steam. There are always local neighborhood leaders. They just have to have a bigger vision so they don't get mired into one issue involving City Hall or something. It absorbs all their anxiety and all their time. They have to have a bigger horizon of change, and that will make them think about these Congress watchdog groups.
Well, I don't want you to think I'm disagreeing with you, because I think this is a terrific book, and it's one of the first, you know, glimmers of hope that I've had in recent weeks or months. But I'm going to push back a little bit, take the devil's advocate. You said that the lobbyists don't have votes, but they do have votes, and those votes are dollars. And dollars is not something that, you know, most of us have. I mean, yes, a lot of people gave to a Bernie Sanders campaign, and yes, you know, we could put some of those small kinds of contributions to hiring a couple of staff members. I think that's a terrific idea. But in terms of elections, we're not going to be giving the millions of dollars that the billionaires are doing.
Yeah, but you see, dollars are desirable to the politicians. For what reason? They want to get votes. They want to put ads on TV. So organized voters overpower organized dollars. And, by the way, if you have that many voters organized, they're going to be able to make the senator or representative understand they can have all the money in the world, but they don't have the votes. The votes corral themselves around real issues, real reforms, real better livelihoods for people. Look at Hillary Clinton outspent Donald Trump 2 or 3 to 1. He actually didn't have a lot of these big packed money. He didn't have as many TV ads, but he was able to win the Electoral College, not the popular vote. He was able to do that because he persuaded people in his own ways to vote for him. In a way, Bernie Sanders proved that you don't have to go to the fat cats to almost beat Hillary Clinton. And I think he would have if it wasn't for the unelected delegates. What did he do? He didn't go around Beverly Hills and Park Avenue and raise big money from a few people. He said, I'm not going to these parties. I'm going to raise it on the Internet and through my speeches. And he raised $225 million, unheard of. He was probably expecting to raise $30 million when he started. Things are changing. You can now raise a lot of money in small denominations. Certainly, if they're wisely used, they can counteract even bigger amounts of money in big denominations because they waste a lot of money. These PACs waste a lot of money, and they start putting the same TV ad on and on and on. People get sick of it, and it doesn't have much effect. But Bernie had organizers. He funded organizers around the country. So votes trump money, number one. And money now is easier to raise in significant amounts from small denominations like Bernie's famous $27 average donation.
And the fact that that was considered to be true, that is true, and we saw that in this past election, maybe leading to the Republicans, which they've been trying to do for a long time, and you talk about in this book, you touch on it at one point, leading Republicans to manipulate elections. I mean, everybody's, you know, the Democrats are talking about the Russians manipulating elections. But, you know, as you point out, between voter suppression, which is massive, and now we're going to have an attorney general who's totally in favor of voter suppression, to, you know, manipulating black box voting machines, are we going to have the vote in 2 or 4 years? And if we don't, what can we do?
Well, the courts are beginning to overturn some of this voter suppression, number one. We have to go for universal voting. That's the way to overcome all of this. In Australia and Austria and some other countries, voting is a duty. It's a legal duty. In Australia, they don't have to spend money, the candidates begging people to turn out to vote. They got 97% turnout. And if they don't show up and they don't have a valid excuse, they're fined $25 or $50, and it goes into the election fund. So that's the only duty that we would add to the jury duty. And the Constitution is full of Bill of Rights, but it only has one duty, which is jury duty, and people like to get out of it. But voting should be a duty, and you take care of the civil liberties problem by saying, look, you can vote for whoever's on the ballot. You can write in your own vote. Or you can vote for binding, none of the above. Basically, no confidence. That ought to take care of all the civil liberty problems. And that's why I favor a binding, none of the above, because if that wins a particular election, it cancels the election and orders new elections in 30 days with new candidates. So I think universal voting is a way to overcome so many of these myriad of obstacles and trap doors that keep people from voting. There's no democracy in the Western world that has so many obstructions to voting and so many obstructions for third-party candidates to get on the ballot and get on debates, as is the dear United States of America.
And, of course, we're going to have to make sure that those votes are counted correctly. Now, you have a 10-point I believe it's a 10-point program. You have a number of points that you say that people can get together on a left or right alliance, left and right alliance, to promote, and that these will expand the power of the populace, of the people, and, you know, return us to government of, by, and for the people. Talk about some of the points in those action plans. What are some of the positions, the issues that left and right can get together on?
Well, I think left-right want clean elections. For heaven's sake, they suspect each other after every election. So if you have these election reforms, which have been around and refined over the years, I think left-right want open debates. I think they want the initiative referendum recall all over the country, not just primarily in Western states, otherwise known as direct democracy. I think they want civil liberties. They don't like the government being able to search your home and not tell you for 72 hours, as the so-called Patriot Act provides, or get into your medical and financial information without probable cause. I think they want criminal justice reform. That's already happening in state legislatures only because Republican and Democrat legislators are working together to make it happen. They certainly want full Medicare for all. They want law and order on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse. They want to put the Wall Street crooks in jail. They're not particularly enamored by all these military adventures overseas and the bloated, wasteful, corrupt military contracting budget. They want to get rid of crony capitalism or corporate welfare, use of tax dollars to prop up mismanaged or corrupt or lazy corporate bosses, like the bailout of Wall Street in 2008, 2009, on the backs of innocent taxpayers after their own pensions and savings were shredded by these corporate crooks. And that's just part of it. I'll bet you they want a better budget for the national parks, which are starving and are falling into disrepair. They want a lot of the consumer protection issues. You think conservatives say, I don't want safeguards for my children. I don't want safe food. I don't want tested medicines. No, when you get down to where people live, work, and raise their family, these conflicting ideologies tend to dissipate because they don't face reality the way people have to face reality on a daily basis.
So, you know, left and right are so siloed in this country. What are the ways that you have seen people reach across those silos to actually get in touch with each other so they can get together on fighting for issues that they both are concerned with?
That's true, because, you know, it's been shown that people back home where they live, work, and play and raise their kids, if they perceive their neighbors disagree with them on because one's liberal, one conservative, they won't socialize with them. And that has led to a real chasm. And, you know, they won't bowl with them. And they won't play ball with them. They won't go to the movies with them. But when they realize that this agenda of convergence, of left-right alliance is up there, it's in the papers, it's door-to-door distributed, they begin socializing. And that's one of the hurdles. The yuck factor and the non-socializing tend to be overcome. And you can have examples of that as we talk all over the country, where left-right get together on a local issue, repair of a school, for example, or saving a park, or repairing a bridge. So anything to get them to know each other, because more and more people don't show up for anything. They're in their living rooms. They have their own entertainment technology, their own cell phone. And there's never been a time in American history when it's harder to get people to show up for town meetings, for demonstrations, or even to start like a little bookstore. And the sidewalks in small town America are empty on Main Street. And all that has to be overcome. And you never require more than 1% of the people to do it.
Well, Ralph Nader, your book, I hope, will help to bring that about. It is Breaking Through Power. It's Easier Than We Think. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Yeah, and I just want to tell your listeners that I'm not talking just theoretically here. I'm talking historically and what we've done with far less than 1% to make the air, water better, and to make automobiles safer and so forth. So it's a very pragmatic book, a six-pack. Get it started. That's where everything good about America starts.
That's great. Well, thanks again.
You're welcome.
Ralph Nader. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Breaking Through Power. Next up, Sarah Van Gelder and The Revolution Where You Live. Stay tuned after the break.
No one ever will if I don't say something, if I just lie still. Would I be a monster, scare them all away, if I let them hear what I have to say? I can't keep quiet, no, 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 I can't keep quiet, no, 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 no. Oh, one moment right.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I remember the first time I saw Yes Magazine in a supermarket checkout line. It was about 20 years ago, and okay, yes, it was Whole Foods. I was so thrilled to find a publication with positive stories about change, rather than the steady diet of gloom and doom that was my usual reading fare. My guest, Sarah Van Gelder, is a co-founder of Yes. But even someone who's been bringing stories about solutions instead of just problems to the public can get depressed sometimes, looking around at the enormous challenges we face in this world and this country. From economic to environmental meltdowns, the crises are overwhelming. But her new book, The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America, is filled with inspiring stories of ordinary Americans working together to confront power, take it back, and make their communities better. The issues they face range from threats to their land and water, workplaces closing down, and poor access to healthy and adequate food and housing, and more. Let's start with a reading by Sarah Van Gelder from The Revolution Where You Live, which she recorded for Writer's Voice.
At the root of these issues, I think, is a system of beliefs and a power structure that allow big corporations and their enablers in government to extract wealth from our natural world and from our communities. A worldview that devalues people of color and turns their land, labor, and bodies into extractable resources is also part of the picture. Until recently, many white Americans believed they would benefit from this system of corporate capitalism, or at least be immune from its worst excesses. But big corporations and the neoliberal policies they endorse have undermined the foundations of the middle class and turned mountaintops, waterways, and urban neighborhoods in the United States into sacrifice zones. They've rolled over small businesses with big box stores, our homes with predatory lending, our schools with privatization schemes, and our medical care with bloated drug costs. Plus, they pushed on us food laden with chemical additives, genetically modified organisms, and antibiotics, which are creating resistant strains of diseases that may soon make routine ailments into life-threatening catastrophes. To tolerate this, we learn to numb ourselves, binge-watching television series, taking drugs, or overeating. We separate ourselves emotionally from our communities, from the natural world, even from ourselves. Schools teach us this, as does advertising. We learn to accept the demise of beloved outdoor spaces and of wild species. Maybe our obsession with cute animal videos is an emotional compensation for the pain of losing the diverse forms of life that wink out on a daily basis. We learn to leave family or community to chase down a better job, to leave our children in sterile childcare centers because we have to earn a few dollars working a low-wage job. We learn from watching nonstop images of violence in the media that other people are not trustworthy. And we learn to use stuff to fill the hole left by isolation and to disassociate from our deepest values. We adopt the values of consumerism and learn to live vicariously via celebrities and to accept the illnesses that come from stress, toxins, and bad food. I'm not sure why we allow all this. I think it must be because we are exhausted by trying to get by. Many people are deep in debt and work multiple jobs to pay the rent. And we're mesmerized by corporate media, and we are isolated. When we lose our connections to each other, we lose our power. We believe we can't change things and can't remake our world. We lose the ability to create an economy together, and we become dependent on big corporations for our livelihoods. And we become less able to resist advertising messages that tell us we are only worth what we can buy. Our isolation, when coupled with economic hardship, makes us vulnerable to the hate speech of demagogues. When we disconnect from the natural world, we lose a grounding, a sense of belonging to a larger community of life, as well as an experience of the wildness and freedom we share with our cousins of other species.
Sarah Van Gelder, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is just a terrific book, a much needed remedy to the despair that is so easy. It's so easy for one to feel these days. The Revolution Where You Live. Now, you spent nearly 5 months traveling 12,000 miles around the United States. You visited 18 states, 5 Indian reservations, 5 industrial cities, and some small towns. Why?
Well, we'd been publishing Yes Magazine for 20 years, and some of the big questions that we had when we started, I was actually feeling were even more pressing now. I'm thinking about things like climate change, the climate crisis, which is rolling out even more quickly than climate scientists anticipated. I'm thinking about things like inequality. We now have something like 20 people in the United States who own as much wealth as half the American population. And I'm thinking about things like racism, You know, we thought, some people thought that maybe having an African-American president was going to take us past this horrible legacy we have of slavery, Jim Crow, lynching, all the things that are part of our American legacy in terms of racism. And of course, that didn't happen. Racism is still every bit as much present in American society. So after 20 years of doing this work, I just thought, you know, is this really working? Are we really making progress? And if not, where are the sources of progress? Because YES was founded to find solutions. And, you know, and I had to ask myself, were we looking in the right places? So I happened to be in Oakland, California. I walked into the office of a friend of mine, Akaya Windwood, and I told her what I was thinking about. And she asked this great question. She said, so if the universe could deploy the one small person that is you, what would it have you do? And I thought about that for just a second, and I said, I think I'd go out and look for myself. And it hadn't occurred to me until she asked that maybe this was the time to just get out of my comfort zone, get out onto the road, and actually visit places where change might be happening and ask those questions.
One of the great things that YES Magazine does, in fact, is show the alternatives. I mean, there is so much of what we do as activists, and especially now in this time of this horrible, government that has been taken over by the worst aspects, the worst parts of our society. We are resisting. You know, there's this whole resist movement. We are against the terrible things that are happening. But what YES Magazine has always done is show the positive, the vision of what we can do. And I think that is so much of what this book, The Revolution Where You Live, does. And you talk about it, about place-based economies. What's a place-based economy, and how is it different than the one we live in?
A place-based economy is simply an economy that's rooted in a community, in an actual physical location, and it's different than the corporate globalized economy. I'm somebody who loves travel. I love seeing other cultures. I love the people who come here from other cultures. I'm not a xenophobe. But I do think our economies belong rooted in place. I think the whole phenomenon of big transnational corporations who roam the world looking for the places where they can extract the most wealth, I think has been terribly destructive to American communities as well as communities around the world. So I think an economy that's place-based is one in which people have a long-term commitment to the community that they are part of. They're very familiar. They're the mom-and-pop businesses that have been in our communities for generations, where people take responsibility for the Boys and Girls Club and contribute to the local charities. And they recognize that their role as business people is not just to extract wealth, it's to be part of something larger, to be part of a human community, and also to be part of an ecological community. Because if you have that kind of a long-term relationship with a place, and you realize that your children and their grandchildren are also going to be relying on the resources of that place, I think you're less likely to, for example, clear cut your local forest. You're more likely to say, you know, how can this forest sustain us over the long term through sustainable forestry practices? So it's that notion that business can be part of a human community and part of an ecological community, instead of almost a predator or a parasite on those communities, that I was really interested in looking at. And I was especially looking in the Rust Belt, because the Rust Belt has been so abandoned by the predatory economy, and there is some really wonderful creative work being done to rebuild the local economy.
Yeah, and I'd like to get back to the Rust Belt, because it was incredibly inspiring, some of the things you found there. But I'd like to start first with the community that you live in. You visited some Native American reservations, and you live on one yourself. Tell us the story of Chief Seattle's home, because that's where you live, where he lived at one time. And the fight for that land and for the park. Is it called the Suquamish Olala community?
The community is the Suquamish community. Our little group was called Suquamish Olala Neighbors. So we started back in 2001. I had just moved to the Suquamish Reservation. I was living in a part of the reservation that's predominantly white, and I moved there simply because I found a house that I could afford to live in. So that's why I moved there. I didn't have any real plans to become an activist. But what happened shortly after I moved in is some of my neighbors knocked on the door and said, you know, the tribe is trying to build housing down the street from us, and we have to stay united against the tribe. And so that was my wake-up call, because, of course, I believe that the tribe should have the right to build housing in their own community, in their own reservation, and anywhere for that matter, but particularly on their own reservation. And so I went to a community meeting where over 100 people were packed into the local church, and one after another were getting up and talking about how we didn't want, quote, those people in our neighborhood. And I was just shocked and appalled and hadn't realized that this was going on in the community I decided to call home. And so finally, after listening to this for a while, I spoke up and said, of course, I thought they had the right to build housing in their own neighborhood and their own reservation. And then I decided to leave the meeting a little early and left. And an elder followed me out. It turned out there was a tribal elder who had been listening to all of that. And he very calmly thanked me for talking. We exchanged greetings, and I went on my way. Shortly after that, though, Chief Seattle's grave was desecrated, and there were newspaper clippings from that particular struggle left strewn around at the gravesite. And I remember, you know, being new in town, I was sort of waiting for the normal human rights leaders, the church leaders, or somebody else to step up, and then I could get in behind them. But nobody was saying anything. Nobody was doing anything. And finally, I got back in touch with that elder, and between the two of us and other friends, we formed an organization called Suquamish Olala Neighbors to try to change that relationship, to try to change those conditions which were leading to so much hostility. So yeah, over the course of years, a number of years, we did some interesting things. We showed up at meetings, and when the folks who were actually my neighbors would come and say, well, the non-tribal community doesn't want this or doesn't like the tribe, we would say, well, that's maybe true of you, but there's actually more of us who are actually supportive of the tribe and their sovereign rights to build housing or to do their fisheries in their traditional ways or whatever the question was. And then at one point, there was an opportunity to reclaim some land that was on the reservation, the land where Chief Seattle's home used to be the largest longhouse in the whole region, 600, 900 feet long, the estimates vary, but a huge longhouse, historically really important, and it had become a state park. The tribe wanted to reclaim that land, and over the course of a couple of years, we worked with them, and we were able to get that done.
So you had white neighbors who were, in conflict with the people, the tribe that had been there, after all, for thousands of years. I think this shows some of the divide, or is resonant of the divide that we, you know, have become so aware of in this country, between those who see themselves in opposition to others versus those who may try to find a way to connect with each other. Were you able to build bridges with the non-tribal members? And what are some of the lessons that you learned about overcoming those divides?
Well, at first it was really difficult because there was such opposition. When we tried to get that land returned to the tribe, they were fighting us tooth and nail and bringing out people like right-wing shock jock radio hosts to try to, you know, make it into some kind of an outrage that the tribe should want this land back. I mean, they were trying all these different tactics. And our decision was simply to stand up for what we believed was right, but to always do that respectfully. So we didn't call people names, we didn't label them racist, or, you know, we just kept on with what we felt was right and filling in the historic reasons why we thought that was the right thing to do. And the tribe also did something that the State Parks Commission recommended. They held a meeting in which they took comments from everybody in the community, including their opponents, about any concerns they had about how that land would be managed once it was transferred to the park. And we very carefully took notes from everybody. We collected their comments. But what we didn't do is we didn't create a platform where people could get up and make the same sort of incendiary comments they'd been making in the past. Instead, we had small groups meeting around tables and taking people's concerns very seriously about security or about upkeep or maintenance or any of those kinds of concerns. And that became part of a management plan for the use of that land. So on the one hand, we listened respectfully and avoided name-calling. But on the other hand, we did not back down from what was, in fact, the tribe's right, which was to reclaim their ancestral land and the land that they kept as part of the treaty process.
That's a great story. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine about the book she has just come out with. It's a terrific book and very inspiring, The Revolution Where You Live. Now, you went on to visit other Native American reservations where people were also building bridges between different communities, between Native American and white communities. I was very struck, especially after, you know, just learning that Donald Trump is now reopening, you know, or trying to reinvigorate the Dakota Access Pipeline Project and the Keystone XL Pipeline Project. You traveled through Montana and North Dakota, where Native Americans and ranchers are working together to shut down fracking and mining. Tell us a little bit about what you found.
So north of Seattle, there's a reservation called the Lummi Reservation, and the tribe there was in the process of fighting a giant new coal export terminal. It would have been the largest in the country for exporting coal, presumably to Asian markets. And the Lummi tribe didn't want that coal terminal because it would have gone through their traditional lands and interfered with their treaty rights to fish. So they had been fighting this coal terminal, and I got curious about, well, where is all that new coal coming from? You know, in this day and age, they're actually going to be increasing production so much that they need an entirely new coal terminal. So I decided to go and find out. So I got in my pickup truck and camper, which I bought to take this journey, and traveled out to southeast Montana. Found out that the place where this mine was proposed was a place called the Otter Creek Valley. It's this lovely, pristine valley filled with ranches, quiet, really quiet place, right adjacent to the Custer National Forest. And I spent time out there. I camped on the land of a member of the Northern Cheyenne tribe, Elena Buffalo Spirit, and interviewed her and her family and ranchers. And what I learned is that this has been a long battle. These folks, the ranchers and the Native people, have been working together for years to try to keep this coal mine from going in. The coal mine would have required a railroad spur that would have gone along this beautiful wild river, the Tongue River, that is adjacent to the reservation. So the tribe was really adamantly opposed to it. Elena was herself. She's a cancer survivor and doesn't want all the pollution that would come along with that new railroad line with, you know, many coal trains a day going by her land. And she also talked about the Bakken oil boom in North Dakota. There's so much oil being extracted, all that fracking going on, that's brought these huge influx of workers, which has brought with it crime and human trafficking and drug abuse and all sorts of problems for the Fort Berthold Reservation, which I visited afterwards. And she didn't want those kinds of issues coming into her land. So she and the ranchers, a local group of environmentalists, were all opposing this for very similar reasons. And the reasons really came down to this sense that they had inherited this beautiful landscape, this beautiful countryside, and beautiful clean water and air. And they felt this sacred responsibility to pass those things along to future generations intact, just as they had inherited them. So it was this beautiful combination of gratitude and humility for what you know, both the ranchers and the Native people were blessed with, and the sense that they were responsible that their children and grandchildren should also be blessed with similar kind of landscape.
And then you also visited the Turtle Mountain Reservation. Is that what it's called? Tell us about that. There was a fight to protect the water because women protect the water. Talk about the role of women and the whole issue of fracking that happened there.
Sure, but one thing I should mention about the Montana situation is after I got home, I learned that the mine had been turned down. The Arch Coal gave up on trying to dig that mine, and they cited something they called regulatory uncertainty, which is sort of a code word for the protests were too much. So essentially, that group of ranchers and Native people won from all of that hard work that they were willing to do because they felt such a strong commitment to their place. And then the same thing happened at the coal terminal, the export terminal, but for slightly different reasons. In that case, it was the Army Corps of Engineers who recognized the sovereign treaty rights that the Lummi tribe has and recognized that they had the right to say no to that project. So it was inspiring both because I got to witness the wonderful effort that these two groups were putting in, but also it was inspiring to see that they could win. So yeah, in Turtle Mountain Reservation, this is in northern North Dakota, really remote area, beautiful, full of lakes and forests. And there an elder had called the women together because the women had this special responsibility for the water in their tradition. And she said, you know, there's this fracking going on in Fort Berthold and it probably is heading our direction. Before it gets here, what do we think about this? Is this something that we're okay with? And so the women did a bunch of research. They looked at what the geology of fracking and what it could do to their water supply and what was happening in Fort Berthold with those same situations, the man camps and the huge influx of money and the corruption that went with it. And they got pretty alarmed. And they said, no, we don't want this here. So they took it to their tribal council. The tribal council called a community meeting, and they ended up agreeing unanimously to ban fracking from their lands. I happened to be there a couple years after that decision was made and interviewed the tribal chairman. And I asked him, you know, how do you feel about that? Here's this, you know, this opportunity to bring millions of dollars into your, you know, admittedly impoverished tribe. You know, how do you feel about leaving all that money on the table? And he said, well, you know, one thing I've learned is that money doesn't buy happiness. And all you have to do is look at Fort Berthold to understand that. And then he said, and, you know, I'm used to making money the old-fashioned way. I earn it. This guy is a small business, you know, business owner, and he doesn't see a get-rich-quick scheme as really being in the interests of his people or his family. In fact, the tribe is now investing in renewable energy and wind energy. There's so much wind out on the Great Plains, and they're seeing that as a much better long-term solution for their circumstances, and of course, that's true of all of us, rather than investing still more in this fossil fuel industry, which is so destructive on so many different levels.
And the ranchers, not only are the Native Americans there investing in alternatives, in other words, not just protesting, but showing the vision of where we can go, but also the ranchers are. Talk about holistic grazing and how that's providing jobs and could combat climate change.
Yeah, that was fascinating. It was not a story I was expecting to stumble on. But there has been for some time this tradition of holistic resource management or holistic grazing. And the theory is that if you treat the land the way it had been treated when there were wild buffalo and other wild creatures, you're going to have a much healthier kind of grasslands. And so they raise cattle in a way that's similar to how herds of buffalo or other hoofed animals behave, which is you keep them grouped up. They dig up the soil with their hooves. They defecate all over it and urinate all over it and spread seeds around, by the way. And then they move off to someplace else and the ground recovers, but it recovers in a much more healthy way because of all that fertilization and the disturbance, but it has time to recover. So he's been practicing that method for quite some time and has become a real believer in how much that can benefit the soil. But more recently, he's become aware that you could take that even further if you really come to understand the soil biology and how complex the ecosystems of healthy soil can be, how many different microbes live in the soil and have these amazing relationships, ecosystems that actually sequester huge amounts of carbon when they're healthy. Because what they do is they're growing a lot of grass, and that grass is pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it deep down into the soil. And it turns out that this process is one of the few, besides reforestation, it's one of the few legitimate ways of getting large amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere. So it has a real serious implication in terms of our climate future. And then it has immediate implications for those particular lands, because those lands will hold water better. And with climate change coming along, that's going to be really important as it becomes increasingly, the water supply, the rainfall becomes increasingly unstable. But these are lands that can hold water much better and are much less likely then to turn into desert. And that's going to be just incredibly important in the future. And one other implication of all of this is that this is more labor-intensive as a way of managing land. It's not going to work to just have huge machinery driving over it as our industrial agriculture usually functions. It takes more effort and more human power. But he said, you know, he started talking about this. He said, you know, we used to think it was such a great accomplishment that somehow fewer people are involved in agriculture. But there's so many young people who would love to work the land and who'd love to learn those skills. And so I think he was onto something, because our whole rural economy, so much of it has been hollowed out because the jobs have disappeared. But what if we started thinking of land management as a skillful occupation in which it takes a lot of people, and you then start rebuilding rural communities on that basis?
And, you know, you say in the book that a lot of the focus of climate activism has been on national and international policy. But what you're showing here is that this local work is having a big impact. Do you think that's still possible in the age of Trump and the Republican and fossil fuel takeover of our government?
You know, I'm really concerned about it, because I think Trump is absolutely serious about revitalizing what is essentially a dying and very destructive part of our economy, the coal economy and the fossil fuel economy more generally. And I think he's doing it for his own immediate profit, because he's invested in those industries, as well as for ideological reasons. But in terms of, if you're actually interested in bringing in jobs, renewable energy is much more likely. Renewable energy and converting our infrastructure to be more energy efficient is far more likely to create large numbers of jobs than trying to bring back these dying industries. So I am really concerned about how much damage he can do. His recent decision to try to get the KXL pipeline and the DAPL pipeline built, in spite of all the opposition, I think is appalling. I think it's going to be a question of relooking at some of the tactics. And I still think the local opposition is going to be absolutely essential. For example, in the DAPL pipeline situation, we've heard a lot about the native opposition. And I actually had a chance to go out there and spend a few weeks covering that. But just recently, a number of the farmers who have sold easements to their land to the Dakota Access Pipeline have taken that pipeline to court and said they weren't treated fairly and they don't want to see this go through after all. So it's this combination, I think, again, of place-based folks, both native and non-native, really figuring out what rights they have and standing up for those rights, and often doing it most effectively when they stand together.
That was Sarah Van Gelder, and alas, we have to stop there due to time constraints. But the conversation continues on writersvoice.net. Go there to hear the rest of the interview with Sarah Van Gelder. You can also read the prologue to her book, The Revolution Where You Live, written by Danny Glover. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.